Just so you know, this show is about scary stuff. So don't say I didn't warn you guys. And remember, don't be scared.
Episode 109, Twisted Love. War Baby here with another episode of Murderous Minors. When 16-year-old Sarah Johnson awoke on the day after Labor Day 2003, the evidence suggests that she decided on murder and it was young love that seemed the catalyst for her break with reason. Blaine County, Idaho had never seen a crime like this. On this episode of Murderous Minors, we look at the tragic, gruesome murders of Alan and Diane Johnson by their youngest child because they didn't like her boyfriend. Let me take a moment to mention that these murders were not only heartbreaking and senseless, but also overwhelmingly violent, so please be advised. Most of the specific details in this episode come from the transcripts of Johnson's multiple appeals. You can also see this case covered on Snapped, Deadly Women, Solved, 2020 on ID and Forensic Files. The small town of Bellevue, Idaho, where no murder had occurred in over a decade in 2003, sits in central Idaho near the Sawtooth Mountains and about 15 miles south of Sun Valley, Idaho, outdoor playground and storied hotspot for celebrities. When the school year started in late August 2003, 16-year-old Sarah Johnson, a junior at Wood River High School, had been dating a 19-year-old named Bruno Santos all summer long. Her parents were aware and had kept Bruno from attending Alan's brother's wedding on the Johnson property the weekend before Labor Day, angering their daughter. Johnson didn't appreciate that they were trying to keep her and Bruno apart, telling her parents that they were in love. Her brother called her Daddy's little princess, but when it came to their mother Diane, the relationship was considerably more rocky. One fight with her mother had gotten so heated that Diane slapped her daughter, who fought back, requiring Alan to break them up. As a younger child, Johnson was well-behaved, courteous, and charming, taking dance classes and doing all the things that little girls did. But by 14, she had been diagnosed as clinically depressed and began taking Wellbutrin as well as Ambien, but showed no evidence of psychosis, conduct disorder, or antisocial personality disorder, and would later be described as a, quote, pretty darn normal girl without violent tendencies by a court-appointed psychiatrist. Her uncle, however, called her, quote, a very spoiled child whose parents gave her whatever she wanted just so she would stop asking for it. She had a few friends, and some of them would later tell police that Johnson was a pathological liar. Her volleyball teammates knew she was dating Bruno, and Johnson even showed them a ring and told them that the two were engaged after her parents were murdered. She was known to pick fights constantly with her mother, according to family like her brother, aunts, and uncle, but at the same time, they found her to be a typical teenage girl who acted in a way that didn't necessarily shock them, until it did. 46-year-old Alan was part owner and an executive at Webb Landscape and Garden Centers and loved to hunt with their son, and 52-year-old Diane Johnson worked in a medical office and had previously been a tax collector. She loved to whip up elaborate dishes in the kitchen. They were affectionate, doting parents who shot trap in a gun club, loved to bowl and throw parties, and were active around their community. The couple had recently celebrated their 20th wedding anniversary, and their son, who was 6 years older than Sarah, was away at college in Moscow, Idaho. By 16 and a half, Johnson was on the volleyball team and loved to read true crime books. She seemed like an everyday girl. As the summer came to an end and Labor Day weekend 2003 rolled around, Diane's sister and brother-in-law came to visit. Her sister said later that it had been love at first sight when Diane had met Alan and that she knew she wanted to marry him. The Johnson home on Glen Aspen Drive in Bellevue, Idaho, sat on an acre of land backing up to a hillside, with a detached garage that had guest quarters above it located adjacent to the home. The guest house tenant, a friend of Alan and Diane Johnson's named Mel, had been renting there for years. Mel stayed in the area for a long-term construction project, but usually spent weekends and time off at home with his wife in Boise, Idaho, about 150 miles from Bellevue. Mel had numerous guns that he kept at his ranch, where his friend Chris was the caretaker. When Mel sold the ranch and moved some belongings to the guest house, Chris helped, testifying later that he moved the guns and boxes of ammunition and had also shot them with Mel's permission. Unknown fingerprints on those items would be identified as Chris's 6 years after the murders. Johnson was known to spend time in the guest house when the tenant wasn't there, sometimes having her friends over to hang out in private, and she also cleaned it for him. Her aunt also reported that while she was visiting that long weekend, just 3 days before the murders, her niece had been caught sleeping over at her boyfriend's house and been grounded. She kept to herself and acted grumpy for the rest of the weekend as she went antiquing with her mom and aunt, and when they returned home, she went to study in the guest house. Johnson stayed in the guest house for several hours, and it was there that investigators believe she concocted a plan for murder. Her aunt also said that while she and Diane had been canning pickles, her niece had come in and asked her mother for the keys to the gun safe, but was told to get them from her dad. This didn't really raise any alarms because although she was in trouble with her parents over her relationship with Bruno, they were still gun enthusiasts who shot for fun all the time. The night before the murders, Johnson had volleyball practice at school, and her teammates noted later that she didn't talk to anyone, playing better and harder than she ever had before. She told her teammates, rather uncharacteristically, that the grounding she'd received for spending the night at Bruno's was deserved. He was there as well and reported that Johnson had been acting weird. Early Tuesday morning may have been chosen specifically to commit the murders because it was trash pickup day, but also the day that it's believed that the Johnsons were going to speak to the police about statutory rape charges. Investigators believe that early Tuesday morning, when she heard her father get in the shower just after 6 a.m., Johnson put her shower cap on her head and her pink bathrobe on back to front before donning gloves. Johnson is thought to have aimed at her sleeping mother's head. The position of the sheet and blanket and of the gun caused the headboard, wall, and ceiling to be covered with high-velocity blood spatter, some droplets so small a microscope was required to view them. The violent impact of the rifle shot sent bone fragments, blood, and flesh flying down the hallway, and as far away as the far wall of Johnson's bedroom, across the hall. Upon search, it was noted that the hinges of her door contained a piece of bone and a sliver of metal from the bullet. Police believe that Johnson shot her mother from Diane's side of the bed at a distance of approximately 3 to 4 feet, causing the spatter to travel above and to the right of the bed, down the hall, and to the furthest point possible in Sarah Johnson's bedroom. The proximity, coupled with the high-powered weapon used, caused terrifyingly traumatic injury to the head. According to a later appeal, quote, when investigating officers lifted the comforter, Diane's head was missing from the chin up. Alan Johnson was confronted in the bathroom by his daughter as he was getting out of the shower to check on the noise. They're believed to have been face to face as he was shot through the left lung, with the bullet leaving a hole in the tile of the shower wall behind him. Father and daughter are thought to have struggled over the gun, depositing Alan's blood on the stock and barrel. The rifle was then dropped on the bathroom floor. It was apparent from the blood around the bathroom that Alan fell to the ground but was able to stand back up, using the counter and pulling down a crucifix and a towel rack from the wall as he made his way toward the phone on his wife's nightstand. He made it there but collapsed face down with his head between the nightstand and the bed, where he bled to death over the next few minutes. His bloody footprints indicated that he first tried to follow the shooter into the hall before turning around to head for the phone. Investigators felt confident that Johnson could have flushed her shower cap down the toilet and grabbed 3 kitchen knives, placing 1 on the bed in her brother's room and 2 on the floor at the foot of her parents' bed, It's also possible that she washed her face, because although they could tell she hadn't taken a shower, there was a damp towel draped over the edge of her bathtub. Investigators believe that the blanket could have kept blood spatter from covering the shooter, even contending that Diane Johnson could have been shot through the blanket. However, it mistakenly wasn't kept as evidence, making it impossible to explore that theory. She likely then took her robe, which had 5 bullets that didn't match the murder weapon in one pocket and the latex glove in the other, and wrapped it around the leather glove, planning to discard them in the garbage that was just about to be picked up. In her room was the matching leather glove and 2 unused bullets matching the murder weapon, along with a full 9mm magazine that matched her father's gun that was locked in his safe. Johnson ran screaming into the street that her parents had been shot, asking if anyone could help her, presumed to have dropped the evidence in the trash can on the way to get help. She pounded on several neighbors' doors before someone came to help her, and other neighbors gathered outside after hearing the gunshots, followed by Johnson's scream shortly after. Those who saw her as police arrived noticed that she didn't look like she had just woken up. She looked freshly dressed and her hair was neat. Some found this weird because they had also just woken up but looked a mess. The neighbor who made the 911 call also noted that Johnson gave her 2 different versions of what had occurred in the minutes after the murders had taken place. At least one neighbor would later testify that they saw her washing her face. When police arrived, they thought at first that they may be dealing with a murder-suicide. However, they quickly ruled this out upon closer inspection of the scene. As officers cordoned off the area and made a perimeter around the house, they were also able to stop the garbage truck as it approached the Johnson home. Inside the trash, officers found the leather glove, latex glove, 5 bullets, and bloody pink robe. The packaging for a pregnancy test was also recovered from the garbage. Family would soon identify the robe as Sarah Johnson's, which made investigators' heads start to spin. When they asked her what happened, they noticed that she had no blood anywhere on her face, body, or pajamas. Johnson told police at the scene that she was woken up by 2 loud bangs, causing her to get out of bed, open her door, and go to her parents' closed door, where she heard what sounded like someone exiting the house through the sliding glass door in their bedroom. She said she ran down the hall and out the front door, going to the neighbor's house for help. When asked if she had thrown anything away lately, she replied by saying that she would never kill her parents. Johnson also told police that around 2:30 a.m. she had heard voices in the backyard and saw the motion sensor light go on, getting up and telling her dad, who told her to go back to bed. But she told police specifically that she heard their cleaning lady's voice and that her parents had looked out the window and saw her in the guest house. She would tell others that her mother and the cleaning lady were having an ongoing feud over a missing bottle of Estee Lauder lotion, and that the woman had even shown up at one of her volleyball games to confront Diane Johnson. When police spoke to the cleaning lady in the days after the murders, they were able to determine that she had only been to the house 1 time the previous week, and that she hadn't known that the Johnsons had been killed. It seems that after the family wedding, Alan and Diane were giving the cleaning service session as a thank you for having lent out their home, after which the lotion came up missing. She'd driven to the home with her boss, and the missing lotion situation had been resolved, with Diane receiving credit for a cleaning in the future. Back at the Johnson home, police tried to determine if the shooter had exited the sliding door and realized that the tracks in the dewy grass actually led to the detached garage and guest house. Murderous Minors is brought to you by Canva. Creating content, though rewarding and fun, can also be challenging and time-consuming. So when content creation is your business, you have to have the tools to help you succeed. Like Canva, the design platform that empowers you to create and share stunning content in just a few clicks. Designing with Canva Pro is empowering because I can start from scratch, or I can save time with thousands of easy-to-customize templates, endless premium fonts, photos, videos, and whatever else I'm in the mood for to personalize my project. Every single project you complete will be unique, I absolutely love the huge variety of fonts, and there really is one available to fit any theme or occasion. And with Canva Pro's Content Planner, you'll save time planning, creating, and posting social media content too. Pause scheduled posts and edit them at any time. Design like a pro with Canva Pro. Right now, you can get a free 45-day extended trial when you use my promo code. Just go to canva.me/warbaby to get your free 45-day extended trial. That's canva.me/warbaby. canva.me/warbaby. Once they started looking around in there, it was apparent that a firearm from the large collection of guns found in the guest house had likely been used in the murder. An unused rifle was found on top of a chest freezer in the garage, as was a box of ammunition that didn't match the murder weapon. A scope that had been detached from the murder weapon was found on the guest house bed, so of course investigators began to look for Mel, the tenant. He ended up coming home to explain that he had inherited most of those guns when his father had passed away. The .264 Winchester Magnum rifle used to kill the Johnsons hadn't been fired in the past 10 to 15 years. He mentioned the victim's daughter's boyfriend, and they learned that just 3 days before the murders, Johnson had told her parents she was spending the night at a girlfriend's house. On Saturday morning, August 29th, when Alan and Diane called looking for her, they found out that she'd never been there. Alan and his brother-in-law drove to Bruno's mom's apartment and retrieved the teenage girl, telling Bruno to stay away or be charged with statutory rape, which as a Mexican citizen meant that he would then be deported. Mel, the guest house tenant, was able to verify his whereabouts over the past few days, and 19-year-old Bruno Santos Dominguez became the main suspect, mainly because he had motive due to the volatile relationship they believed him to have with the victims. The Johnson's family members had also mentioned his possible involvement for the same reasons that the tenant had brought him up. Police were aware that the Johnsons planned to speak to the sheriff's office that Tuesday regarding possible charges, since Monday was a holiday. Before officers could locate him, Bruno showed up at the crime scene on his own, telling police that he wanted to see if Johnson was okay. He said that his cousin worked at the high school and had called and woke him after the administration announced the murders to the entire student body over the PA system. He was cooperative at the scene, allowing officers to search his vehicle, and was taken directly to St. Luke's Hospital to be examined for evidence and checked for gunshot residue. He was photographed, and his hair, blood, and clothing were collected to be tested for DNA. Johnson was also at the hospital being examined, and when she embraced him in the hallway, he didn't hug her back. She reportedly told him she was sorry and not to worry. Law enforcement knew that Bruno was undocumented and that even if they didn't charge him with a crime, they were still required to notify immigration authorities regarding his citizenship status. He would be deported and they would lose access to him well before any DNA test results were completed. If it turned out that his DNA did match any at the crime scene, he could be out of their grasp. Bruno Santos was arrested and police meticulously checked his clothing for any fibers, blood, or evidence they could find that could link him to the Johnson murders, but found nothing. Neither of Sarah's parents' blood were found on Santos's clothing, and the only DNA of his they ever found at the Johnson home were semen stains in Sarah's bed. They knew he had been in the Johnson home against Alan and Diane's wishes, but there was no DNA or fingerprints within the actual crime scene that placed him there on the day of the murders. Police had to release him, and he was sent back to Mexico, though they had a difficult time with the realization that he hadn't been involved. Johnson's brother, away at college, was also awakened by a phone call telling him that his parents had been shot. When he arrived at the house around 3 p.m., he said that his sister came running down the street towards his car, and that the first thing she said to him was, quote, "They think I did it." He said he told her that he thought Bruno had done it, but he said she told him that there was no way because he loved Alan Johnson like a father. She then told him about the so-called cleaning lady incident from the night before, but the story was rife with inconsistencies regarding what she said their parents did. First of all, she said that both of their parents got up and went to check when he knew for a fact that his mother would have stayed in bed. And honestly, he said Alan would have either called the police or released the dog from its kennel. He didn't tell his sister that he didn't believe her. The siblings stayed together at Johnson's godmother's home for the following 2 to 3 weeks, sometimes spending the night at the Blaine County Jail for protection in case someone was out to harm their family. Johnson had told police that the knives at the foot of the bed and on her brother's bed were gang messages, symbolizing that they were marked. The pair stayed close and her brother was truly scared. He described his sister as being a practiced liar, testifying later that, quote, "You can stretch a lie a little bit and you can stretch a lie a lot," and sometimes she would take it to the extreme. Each lie began with a seedling of truth. As time went on, Johnson even began to suggest that her brother was responsible for their parents' murder once the cleaning lady lead had dried up. The investigation was swiftly running out of suspects who once felt like solid leads with the ruling out of Mel the tenant and Bruno Santos the boyfriend. Investigators ruled out a botched robbery or a murder by stranger and truly felt that whoever killed the Johnsons was very familiar with the home and its contents. Sarah Johnson herself kept bringing the possibility of her involvement to the foreground as forensic testing was being completed in the background. Police had noticed her odd behavior nearly every time they saw and spoke to her, beginning with the day of the murders when she sat on the fence and watched unemotionally as her parents' bodies were brought from the house. Onlookers said she looked like a spectator at a sporting event, not a child seeing her parents' bodies being carried out in bags. To friends and family members, she acted like everything was normal, talking about getting her nails done and being more concerned with going to volleyball games and seeing her friends than consoling her grandparents or trying to figure out who would kill her mom and dad and why. Her aunt said that if people got emotional about the murders in front of her, the teen would roll her eyes in disgust and act annoyed. But they talked about it with her and tried to keep her busy with football games and family outings and going to the gym. At her mom and dad's funeral, Johnson was happy and acted like it was some kind of social event, exiting the vehicle like she was arriving at a ball, according to a police officer that was there, and photos from that day. The teen never said she would miss her parents or acknowledged their deaths and never expressed a desire to find or catch their killers. She told volleyball teammates that she and her brother would be set for life financially, but her aunt overheard her telling someone on the phone that her brother was going to get everything. Investigators had really tried to find evidence that Bruno Santos had committed these murders either alone or with Johnson, but none existed. And as the weeks wore on and the investigation into her possible involvement wore on, Johnson was interviewed on multiple occasions, giving different versions of what happened that morning each time. Sometimes she said the shower woke her. Sometimes she said the first shot woke her. Sometimes she said she heard one shot while in bed and one shot at her parents' door, while other times she recalled hearing both shots from bed and hearing the sliding door open and close while standing at her parents' door. Sometimes she said she didn't even go to her parents' door but ran through her bathroom and into the hall, then out the front door. Sometimes she didn't go through the bathroom and ran right into the hall before exiting the house. Johnson had told one friend that she heard arguing while she stood at the door, and told someone else that she'd heard a body hit the floor. She told some that she heard the front door open and close, and mentioned to someone else that she heard someone run out the front door. Johnson also changed whether she could see into her parents' bedroom or not, mostly saying that the door stayed closed, but telling some that she looked in but didn't see anything, which couldn't be true. She told a friend that she could see inside, telling her that she would have to think about what she'd seen forever. But she told her brother that the door was closed. When police arrived that morning, they noted that the master bedroom door had in fact been propped open by a pillow to keep it from getting too warm on the late summer night. This made it impossible for Johnson to have approached her parents' closed door, as she'd told police. They had her DNA and fingerprints by then, and Johnson had since gone to live with her aunt and uncle, who were well aware that she was either involved in or had committed the murders on her own. While living there, she told her aunt that she saw her parents in her dreams. Her mom was cooking in their kitchen, but her face was blanked out. Her father approached, but she didn't want to hurt him because he had a missing space in his chest. He told her she couldn't hurt him anymore. Family took turn keeping her under supervision in cooperation with the authorities while they tried to accrue enough evidence to arrest someone. Everyone wanted to make sure that she and Bruno didn't run off together. At school, friends reported that she didn't appear to be sad at all. One volleyball teammate recalled that Johnson had asked her to find Bruno and tell him that she loved him no matter what happened. Her friend said that she knew then that Johnson had killed her parents. Police kept coming back to these reports from her family and friends of her ever-present bizarre behavior. The three linear bruises photographed on Johnson's left shoulder on the day of the murders, marks that could have been left by recoil and were indicative of having recently shot a rifle or shotgun. She told them that she'd fallen down and was sure to point out that she was right-handed, so the bruise being on her left shoulder didn't add up. Johnson was arrested and charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder nearly 6 weeks after the crimes, just after 8 p.m. on October 29, 2003. Her DNA was found inside the latex glove and on the robe. All 3 gloves and the robe also had gunshot residue on them. There was high-velocity blood spatter that was a mixture of both victims' blood on the outside back of Johnson's pink bathrobe. Fibers and dried paint flecks from her pajama top were also found inside the back of the pink bathrobe. The DNA from inside the latex glove was the final piece of evidence that police needed to make the arrest. Investigators recalled that Johnson was defiant and angry following her arrest. Her trial was moved to the Ada County Courthouse, 150 miles away in Boise, to allow for a jury pool less likely to be tainted by pretrial publicity, even though a gag order had been enforced by the judge early on in the case. This episode is brought to you by Best Fiends. Longtime listeners of this show already know that I love Best Fiends, the best match 3-style puzzle game out there, and believe me, I've tried them all. I've popped bubbles and crushed candies and everything in between, but Best Fiends' thousands of levels and counting always bring me back. Playing through the story with the good guys, bad guys storyline makes it so much more fun, and adorable, ever-changing characters make me look forward to coming back for more. When your job is as draining as researching true crime day in and day out, you need a solid outlet to relieve the sadness, and Best Fiends is still my go-to 4 years later. And I never have to worry about outgrowing the game because with more levels added all the time, there'll always be something new to play every day for a long time to come. Best Fiends is free to download, so if you haven't joined us yet, what are you waiting for? Fun is not just for kids. Download Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. When trial began 18 months later, her ex-boyfriend Bruno Santos was brought from Mexico to testify against her. He said that Johnson had told him that she hated her father for trying to keep them apart, even mentioning that she should shoot him. Prosecutors argued that she planned to use her inheritance to finance a life for her and Bruno. Johnson's public defender was adamant that his client was innocent, confident enough to coin a term for his defense, no blood, no guilt, referring to the fact that Johnson had no blood on her when tested. He presented graphic photo after graphic photo from the crime scene to the dismay of the victim's family and friends. And although Johnson's attorney had floated that it was entirely possible for Bruno to have recruited friends to commit the murder due to his gang ties and drug activity, when it came time to cross-examine him, the defense declined and didn't question any of his family members either. Johnson's older brother was the final witness for the prosecution, seeing that his younger sister often told their mother that she hated her and that she had an explosive temper. He said she always had to be right and was constantly bickering and arguing with their mother. Though the defense had accused Johnson's brother of being greedy and testifying so that he could ensure a conviction and receive Sarah's portion of the life insurance, he said that he was just helping to find his parents' murderer. He tried to catch his sister's eye while in court, looking for a hint of innocence, but all he got back, he said, was cold-blooded dagger eyes. The Johnsons' family members were convinced of Sarah's guilt by the time the trial was over, even though they didn't want to be. Her grandmother, Diane's mother, said, quote, "It takes a lot of evidence to convince a grandmother that her granddaughter killed her daughter, and it just got to the point where it was no one else. Nothing pointed to anyone else, and everything pointed to Sarah. She did it." Johnson declined to take the stand in her own defense, even after the judge explained the repercussions of her decision and that this was her one chance in this trial to try and solidify her innocence in the eyes of the jury. Following the 6-week trial, which was broadcast live on court TV and ultimately cost roughly $1 million, Sarah Marie Johnson, then 18, was found guilty on both counts of first-degree murder on March 16, 2005. The jury spent 11 hours over 3 days in deliberations and were required to review hundreds of pieces of evidence, as well as the testimony of more than 100 witnesses. Johnson's brother said that hearing the guilty verdict was one of the worst parts of the entire ordeal. He knew what he knew, he said, but to get confirmation was devastating. When she was sentenced in May of 2005, a combined 11 family members and friends spoke up, including her brother, aunts, and grandmother, with all but 2 friends imploring the judge to sentence the young woman to life in prison. Her 24-year-old brother and only sibling specifically requested a maximum sentence because once the sentence was read, he planned to never revisit this part of his life again. Johnson addressed the court, saying tearfully, quote, "I love my parents and I love my family. I am deeply grieving the loss of my parents as well as the loss of my family, my home, my friends, and my community. I am very thankful for the love and support that my adoptive family has given me. With the guidance of the Lord and the continued love and support of those that believe in me, I hope to rebuild my life and prove that I can be a productive member of society." Multiple appeals and motions have been dismissed and denied in this case, with ineffective assistance of counsel coming up more than once. The issue of fingerprints that were unidentified at trial but were later determined to be the tenant's friends was also floated as possible grounds for a retrial. There were requests for new DNA testing, which have been consistently denied, even on appeal, and there was the contention that her 2 JLWAP sentences violated the Eighth Amendment. The DNA issues were twofold. First, Johnson wanted to rerun samples that were previously unmatched in the law enforcement databases due to all the samples that had been added since. But this was not allowed under the Idaho Code, which allows post-conviction testing of DNA in the event of new technology and in certain other specific instances, like if the new evidence could result in proving Johnson wasn't the shooter. This was not the case here, as the presence of unidentified DNA and fingerprints at the scene had not led the jury to believe that Johnson wasn't the shooter, even though they were fully aware of their existence. The court concluded that the DNA test results would, quote, "do nothing to lessen the evidence produced at trial that implicated Johnson, and that evidence was substantial." Eighth Amendment violations were dismissed based on the fact that the sentencing hearing was basically a hearing to determine if the murders reflected the transient immaturity of youth, considering that her youth was discussed and experts testified about adolescent brain development. That portion of her motions was also denied, as they were able to show that the trial court took Johnson's age into consideration when determining her sentence. Her successive petitions have been denied, and the appeals of their denials have also been dismissed. Even assistance from the Innocence Project hasn't secured Sarah Johnson a new trial, although they've been helping her for almost a decade. Sarah Johnson is 34 years old in 2021 and continues to serve out her two life without parole sentences at Pocatello Women's Correctional Center in Pocatello, Idaho. Her former boyfriend, Bruno Santos, has been deported to Mexico at least four times since the Johnsons' murders, and most recently had contact with Blaine County, Idaho law enforcement in April 2011, when he was arrested with his cousin trying to sell a half pound of methamphetamine to an undercover officer in a sting operation. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison in July 2011 and was paroled in May 2018. A juvenile female committing parricide or the killing of her own parents was exceedingly rare then and continues to be, 18 years after the Johnsons' murders. A friend did point out in her statement at sentencing that limiting Johnson's access to firearms could have made this a different story. I'll leave you with the words of Sarah Johnson's own aunt, who said, quote, "There was absolutely no reason for her to do what she did. She loved her dad so much and he loved her. And if she could do that to him, what's to stop her from doing it to somebody else?" As always, thanks for listening. Be back next week with an all-new episode, but until then, lovelies, don't be scared.